You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
We are diving today back into something that is as raw as it is disturbing. Virginia Giuffre's posthumous memoir, Nobody's Girl. It is out there now. A lot of us absorbing it. It's a long read. It's a very powerful read. And we're going to continue to break this down. It's not just another retelling of the Epstein horror show. It is her full life story, from the first betrayal at home to the systematic grooming that followed. This isn't tabloid sensationalism. It's a psychological roadmap of how predators find, shape, and silence their victims. And joining us to continue, help us break this down, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Drake. We're going to look at how Epstein and Maxwell built their web, how fear and coordinating turn victims into compliant participants, and what this memoir reveals about the machinery of exploitation itself. Robin, you've finished the book. I'm about a quarter way into it. Walk us through why this book is a game changer for understanding sex trafficking, grooming from start to finish. I know this has affected you greater than a lot of other books on this topic and things that we've seen on this topic.
Yeah, even as you're reading the intro, Tony, I mean, it's hard not to get misty thinking about it. This book really shook. She was so transparent and so vulnerable from the very first pages of this book. It was shocking in a way that a behaviorist admires and is grateful for, because you know, we've covered these cases a lot. I've covered human behavior a lot. But she gave a granular detail about her life and the entire arc from her being a little girl all the way up through everything. So we got an understanding of her decision process, of her optics on life, of everything around her. And she offered immediately such a level of transparency and vulnerability, owning everything she did in life. It wasn't rose-colored glasses, like she's nothing but a victim. She talked about how she victimized others, which gives an amazing amount of veracity to everything that she says, because she was willing to disclose every nook and cranny of her life. And it was extremely compelling, disturbing beyond belief. It introduced me to, as I say often on the show and with you and Stacey and Todd, I'm not a conspiracy theory guy, although this book opened some doors of possibility for me. Is like, wow, this just doesn't make sense. Some of these things just don't make sense with what we're seeing. So anyway, that was my immediate effect of this whole thing.
Go ahead, Stacey.
Can I interject before we really get going here? We have a lot of women who are in our chat on a daily basis. At least I can tell from the names and the pictures. Yeah. I'm just assuming. So I want to kind of put a little bit of a warning out there. But Robin, from your perspective, since you finished it, for those of us, and I'm not ashamed to say I've been SA'd in my life, is this a book that we should read, could read? What are your thoughts on that? Because I didn't read it specifically because I felt I would get triggered, but I did watch an interview with Amy Wallace, the co-author.
Right.
It was about an hour-long interview of her talking about it. And to me, it sounds fascinating from a perspective of I could learn a lot from this. So what are your thoughts, if you don't mind my taking the conversation that way first?
Stacey, you bring up a great point. This is can potentially be an extremely triggering book. It's probably the most granular of detail I've ever seen. And I was in the Innocent Lies Foundation as a board member, and we tracked down pedophiles and human traffickers of children. And I've never had anyone describe in such very, very specific detail exactly what was done to her from the very get-go. So I think you did a very smart thing. And I think if anyone is curious and is afraid of being triggered, dip your toe in the water first. Watch an interview, see how you respond to it, and take it lightly. Be able to reflect and have a conversation with people during this to keep yourself grounded if needs be. But as a way of the other thing you said of being important, I think it's extremely important. It really broadened my understanding and depth of compassion. And I feel myself a pretty compassionate person most days. It really deepened my depth of understanding because of this book. So I think if you're a victim of sexual abuse or trafficking, it's going to be triggering, and it'll be empowering, I think, to know that there's other women out there that are there on your side. I think some of the awareness of what they've been through might be good because of the whole collective mindset that you can come together. And she speaks of resources that she started, obviously, at the end of it as well. But at the same time, for those that haven't, people like me that care very deeply about protecting others and serving others, it is a very important read. I won't say mandatory because it is very disturbing. I don't recommend it to someone who can't necessarily weather the storm without some good, healthy people in your life. But it is very enlightening. Matter of fact, it makes you feel very compelled to want to do something because of the tragicness of this. I mean, just as an example, and the estimate is that Epstein alone, and I know this from my stats of work in Innocent Lives Foundation, affected, they think, anywhere between 200 to 300 girls. And that's profound if you now think about that pattern of life that then happens to them and the people in their lives. I mean, and she so accurately said it. It's like these monsters, and I'm going to get into the term I used for him, and I came up with him for him, set a ticking time bomb at the very early stages of their lives. And every single day they have to weave around how to defuse that ticking time bomb that could go off inside of them at any day. And that time bomb of suicidal thoughts, self-harm, it's just profound. The words can't even capture how profoundly impacted it is. So to your point, Stacey, I think it's a good read. It's a powerful read. It's an important read. But if you're worried about it, dip your toe in slightly, watch a video, watch an interview, you know, get some more, a little more depth of field to see where down your own personal path you are, where you can kind of absorb more, because it is in depth, very in depth.
Thank you for that.
I want to start here because this is something that, this book is out. People are absorbing it. People are hearing more and more of these horrible stories. How does it make you feel as, you know, obviously someone who was formerly in the FBI, as a human being, when you have the current director of the FBI saying there is no credible information, none, that Epstein trafficked women to girls other than himself?
He said that.
He said that.
So
yes,
so
he said that.
It's easy to parse words. You know, I've heard him and Bongino both say numerous times, and I don't do politics on anyone, as you know.
I know, but I'm just saying, as a human, politics out of this. This it's just such a chunk out of that just diverts from reality is what it is. It's not political. It's just we know what the hell he was doing. How are we backing it up to here to say there's no credible information, none? It's like saying there are no stars in the sky. There's no credible information that there are any stars out there. None.
I don't know how. So if he said that, again, I apologize. I haven't heard him say that.
Sure.
If he had said that, or anyone said that, it's kind of ludicrous because the lawsuits and the settlements they have actually showed that he trafficked. Matter of fact, Maxwell was convicted because she was convicted of trafficking.
Exactly. Then why is she in prison if they never trafficked any?
He was convicted of trafficking.
Yeah.
You know, and,
yes.
And it was, you know, and you know, so you're talking about the powerful in this thing. You know, I actually did I did research. You know me, I love doing research when little things pop up. But what was interesting to me is that also on this whole weirdness of this, the likelihood of suicide by someone like Epstein because they have that power control is so remote. And you know I'm not a conspiracy guy. So, and I love data points. And data points say someone like Epstein would not commit suicide, especially at the earlier phases of this. So if that's true, then what you need law enforcement to do to inspire faith and confidence and trust in organizations, institutions, you need to have full transparency to say why this is data points an anomaly from what we would typically expect or see and have seen from past cases. And now here's the rub on it. The people that, and I don't know how you do this, the people that give you that transparency can't be from the same elite that just committed suicide.
There you go.
And so I would, so here's what Robin Dreeke, both average guy and former FBI guy and knowing my organization would love. I would love a GS-13. That's what I retired as. You have the GS-13, which is journeyman level, like spent 22 years as a special agent. I did go into management. So I ran our behavioral team. I stepped back down to be a street agent, you know, years before I retired. What I want to have the case agent, that GS-13, talk about the case. I don't want an executive to talk about it. I want transparency. If we're going to see a data point anomaly, if they're looking to build trust and confidence in the things that they're saying, I want the actual investigator and the team, that those ground grunts, to talk about the case and take questions. The likelihood of you seeing that is no, slim to none, but these are not elites. These are people like me that were just trying to do the righteous work.
That's what just makes it insane to hear a statement like that. Again, this is not political. This is just ground level. Okay, if we're not going to play on the same reality team here, then, I mean, this is nuts. When people are absorbing this, they're going to look to their government. They're going to look for leadership. They're going to look for, okay, we have to accept this is what happened. And if we're pretending it didn't, we're just making shit up and erasing history at this point, if these are the statements being made by those that are supposed to be there to protect us. It's shocking. I mean, you can watch the video. It's out there. He testified to it. The exact words.
They keep it. You know, it's interesting. Word modifiers. I always focus in on word modifiers. Yeah. We've covered this before. Like when people use the word, before influence, any word modifier before anything. So anything saying credible information or credible intelligence, you know, just saying credible means that they're using that as an excuse for what comes next. So they're saying they do have information, they do have data, they do have data points, but they're not deeming it credible from their optic. And so it's a word modifier before the actual word. That kind of stuff always kind of bothers me.
And it's not even like, okay, we're breaking this apart because we're protecting, like, anyone. It's like saying that to anyone other than himself. Like, I get it's not right, but if you're going to go, okay, well, there was other people, but just not this guy that you may be looking at. Like, come on. It's insane.
And so here's what you can also do. I'm so sorry, Tony. There's so much content here on this.
Yeah.
So herself. So here's another thing I looked up, because she even was criticized because, you know, the naysayers and people that are attacking her were criticizing her credibility, false memories and things like that. So I actually looked up testimony of credibility of testimony by people that are suffering PTSD and things like Virginia, Jenna, suffered is actually extremely accurate memories that she has. What's going to be, because of the way that it's imprinted on the memory, what happens is that timelines get screwed up, dates get screwed up, because that's the type of memory that she's disassociating with.
Sure.
But the memory and the images of the people themselves, extremely credible, highly credible. Because, and she even says it, she can't get rid of the images of someone being on top of her and what their face would actually look like. And so those memories are extremely credible. And so again, for someone to say that it's not, it just goes against all the science, all the research. And so not just one person's, and then you just look at her life arc of the disclosure she's having. I would think any, so here's what I would do. And here's what I did do when I was in the Bureau, working my violations and the things I did in the world of counterintelligence and human behavior. I read everything I could. When something new came out, I consumed that information, because that's the path of wisdom, is gain information, put into practice, and hopefully you learn more. This is a must read. This is a must read for anyone working this violation, because it is so important to understand what the victims, because this was a book about the victims, what they go through and how they had to try to live their lives, not by the 5-second highlight reel that people try to manipulate outside and what they project to the world to try to show strength, mm-hmm. but the internal things that are going on in them is what was really bone crushing to hear. And also the physical, you know, it's funny. I do so much research in so many different areas, and Body Keeps a Score is another great book that talks about the physical effects that trauma has on us. She was riddled with so many things physically as she got older and eventually died by suicide, presumably. Mm-hmm. And just those physical tolls, all this took on her. That's what these monsters, and monsters isn't even a word, that captures what this soul ripper does. That can't even capture the devastation that's caused this one person, then everyone in their life as well.
Yeah. Soul Ripper is right. That, and we were texting about that, and it's like, how would we just, you describe this in Soul Ripper? And that's exactly.
I want to tell you why it's Soul Ripper too. You know, when I first started reading this, and you know, we'd even commented at the end of the last show about the word evil, he's evil. And I was like, you know, that word just doesn't kind of capture it.
Yeah.
Evil's context. Evil can be seen scientifically, unscientifically, and it just doesn't, you know, people like Kober can be evil. You know, Rex Huerman can be evil. You know, these, but what this non-human, I won't even call him human, what this non-human was doing was beyond that, because they take this soul, and it's not even from a religious standpoint, that what internally makes a human being up is what I'm calling a soul, and can be spiritual if you want, it can be anything you want it to be. It's what makes us up in here. Because what they do and what he did was he took it and he's ripping it apart. He's not stealing it. He's not killing it, because that would be too easy. He's literally ripping it apart, that this person now tries to have to hold it together and try to rebuild their soul. That's why I called it ripping, for the rest of their lives. And maybe or maybe not they're going to make it. So these people are just soul rippers. Because that's exactly, they're destroying the internal makeup of these human beings that are trying desperately to hold them together in a world that's been turned upside down for them.
Let's get into some of the book early on. And I want to say this too, her father denies any allegation that she makes in it that's addressed very early on, but she goes on to tell her story. But I wanted to get that out there. The book, it lays bare her early trauma at the hands of her father. She calls him the original betrayer in the book. How does that kind of parental betrayal, how does that set up a victim's entire life arc for predators like Epstein to exploit?
Yeah, it sets up a behavior pattern in numerous different areas. Again, I always want to caveat, especially when we start talking about this stuff like this, I'm not a licensed clinician, psychologist, or any of these things. This is just pure observation and life reps of doing this and working with people in human behavior. But it sets up an expectation of what they can reasonably expect from the people in their lives, especially male in this circumstance. And it sets up a need to want to be approved and want to be loved and want to be cared for and want to be nurtured. And then it may also make you very cognizant of fear. And she was extremely fearful of her father, and she didn't want to be alone with her father. And then the father started trafficking her. So it sets up a pattern of behavior of understanding what the world around you is and what is presenting itself. And then also it makes you a problem solver at a very young age, because she's constantly having to solve her own problems. And what also happens, what I saw happening as she's describing it, she was doing a very good job of being a problem solver. But the problem is the quality of people that she had in her life, she had no healthy relationships on which to rely for problem solving. So she kept she kept having to lean into more unhealthy people that were completely destroying her life, or become an agnostic to it, like she says her mother was. And she constantly then was seeking the approval and wanting to be accepted by these horrendous men, including her father, up until the very end. She kept trying. Here's this man she accused of raping her, of abusing her, incest, then trafficking her to her friend, her father's friend, exchanging daughters. I mean, this is horrendous stuff. And yet, she would never kick him out of her life.
Yeah.
That's what happens. And that's what that time bomb starts setting off. And so then people then have leakage of vulnerability. And it's not vulnerability or a weak person, but vulnerability of seeking to be valued and acknowledged by others and wanting to be approved by the people that you think are important in your life. And then people like Maxwell come around and they can recognize it. And they can recognize a little bit of nonverbal leakage come out. And then they test, where are we at? Where are we at? Where are we at? And then they try to groom you, although the grooming they were doing was exceptionally fast, into this lifestyle.
Just the psychology. Obviously, the father's never been charged with anything. He denies all the allegations.
Yep.
But if we're going to go off of what she's saying and the claims, I mean, that and it's, I mean, just... we're always trying to put ourselves in someone else's prism and someone else's mind. How are they thinking the way they are thinking? This is just one that is like, I don't know in any way, shape or form, other than the word, soul ripper or evil to describe. I mean, we're both fathers. We both have daughters. I do not in any way, shape or form. I cannot do the mental gymnastics in any capacity to understand what the hell would be going on with a father, number one, that would abuse their kid that way, but then to like give their daughter to somebody else for this purpose to swap. I mean, it's just so, so insane. So like, what the fuck is going on in that brain that allows that is the modality and the choices that person is making at that point in time, and they think it's a good idea, other than it is just something purely dark. It's inhuman.
They are an alien species.
Yes.
And what makes it even more profoundly troubling that I've never seen in a case before is Maxwell.
Yes.
And so here's how part of this grooming and targeting process was Maxwell. So here's how they targeted her. She's working at Mar-a-Lago as a girl, doing towels and being accommodating, and she loved working there. It was good training, good people. She said very good, very complimentary things. Nothing disparaging against Trump or the organization. Matter of fact, from what I understand, as soon as that they found out, because Epstein had another charge against him by someone, a daughter or someone at the club, and this is before anything legal happened, they actually kicked him out. So they did a good job. The organization did a good job back then of getting rid of him, according to what I've read, in the book and everything else. But what happened was Maxwell was trolling because Epstein lived close to Mar-a-Lago. She's trolling there. She sees her. She approaches her because what Maxwell was doing was she was grooming them, giving them a feminine social proof that, hey, this is okay. I'm a female. You're a female. We'll be females together. And this is what we do to service poor Epstein, who's just – he's got too much sexual energy. Oh, you want to be a masseuse? Well, we'll give you some training. Come on in. You can try right now how to be a masseuse on this very wealthy man. And look, it's okay because I'm here with you. Little did they know, she's a monster too. She was used for the grooming, for the social proof for the girls that she identified as being vulnerable. Then they trained the girls to go get more girls like them. In other words, hey, go find more vulnerable people like you. Oh my God, what a network.
The mental gymnastics that go on. I mean, and it's driven by fear. I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, you always say fear is the rocket fuel for compliance in cases like this. I mean, how would you say the book Nobody's Girl, it shows fear driving every decision that Virginia made, from recruitment to staying silent for years?
Yeah, she feared not having money. She feared being homeless. She feared not being accepted. She feared being retribution against family, against her brothers. I mean, and this is what they all get driven by. It's the fear of being cast out. And so what happens is these monsters are redefining what acceptable is at a, and I, it's the speed of which they're able to do it, because what happened was Maxwell became that accelerator because she was female. The other females that were part of this cabal, given that 5-second highlight reel saying, hey, this is okay. Meanwhile, internally, they're destroyed. 5-second highlight reel to give that social proof because they're seeing other girls around. It must be okay. Everyone's right. doing it. It must be okay. And then they normalize it by, because Epstein thought this was completely acceptable. He was, the rationalization he was given of, well, throughout times, you know, it was acceptable age for women to have carnal knowledge of other males has varied, you know, different states vary. So who's to say that this isn't good for now? I mean, what the hell? He totally just regarded females as screwdrivers in their lives.
Robin, can I interrupt for a second? Alicia made a really good comment, and it's something I thought about 10 minutes ago, and I don't want to sound like I'm defending Maxwell in any way, shape, or form, but could she have been a victim of 100%. Abuse when she was younger as well? Do we 100%. Know a lot about Maxwell?
No, not as much. At least I haven't seen as much, because I knew she came up from a very wealthy family. Mm-hmm. And that
Which means nothing.
The father got in trouble and they had lost, from what I understand, and because Jenna talks about this in the book a little bit, because they... Both Maxwell and Epstein wouldn't. She kept trying every now and then to probe to find out a little bit more about their background, and they immediately put up walls. But what she knew about Maxwell was that she did come from money, and the money was lost at some reason or however. But there's no doubt she came from a very dysfunctional household or place that taught her that this is the way we service men, because that's what she was doing. This was. I do not believe. Pure conjecture that this was a behavior that she learned from Epstein. I think this is what Epstein saw she was capable of doing, because she was already groomed into it before he even met her and became a perfect match.
It's almost scarier to think of Ghislaine Maxwell not being abused as a child sexually.
Yeah.
It doesn't give her grace. It doesn't give her any sort of excuse, but it gives you the recipe. You know, it's like, well, I mean, okay. I mean, that the explains the wiring to a certain extent, not all the way, but it's like, okay, it does tend to repeat sometimes. But we don't know, you know, there is no information out there about her past to answer that question. But I mean, one would, you know, if you're putting money on it, I would certainly say she had to have been. But that's the I think one of the things that makes Ghislaine Maxwell such an enigma to so many people, because she is a woman and she, you know, gallivanted around with other women and you know, well-known women, people that people respected at that point in time as well. And it was this, you know, society type woman who was out there doing these horrible things behind the scenes. That's the hard one to grasp. Why would a woman actively recruit other young girls to be victimized? And she knew they were being victimized, but she also, you know, allegedly participated in some of these victimizations, if you will, too, in the essaying. What's going on there? How does someone do that, especially to their own gender, that one would know the damage that this sort of shit does to people? Unless, was Ghislaine a weird specimen out here that was not affected by SA in a negative way? Like in some way, shape, or form, was that a positive in her brain? And she's sharing this with, I'm just trying to wrap my mind around this, because it's inhuman. It is inhuman behavior.
She's never owned the behavior as being abhorrent, and she denies everything.
Yeah.
As I'm reading this, I know it's going to sound like a jump, but here's what goes through my mind. I've read a lot on World War II. I've read a lot on Auschwitz. I've read a lot about Hitler and how he did what he did. And I'm going to tell you, the imagery I got while I'm reading this book is that we have Hitler as his belief of eugenics and a superior genetic coding of white Aryan males against the Jews. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, Epstein was given himself as the superiority of the male gender against all the females, and you're to service me. And like Rudolf Goering was to Hitler, Maxwell was to Epstein. because they were all in on his line of shit about how we just have to service males. This is the way that life works. And his mind, I actually wrote this crap down. Because so Jenna did a good job of quoting him sometimes. This is exactly what he said that she said in the book. It's just the way men are genetically imprinted. Epstein thinks everyone acts like he does.
Wow.
Genetically. So as soon as I heard that genetically imprinted, what goes on in Robin's mind? Well, that's exactly what Hitler thought. This is just genetics. This is just the way it is. And so when you indoctrinate, or someone's already been indoctrinated like Maxwell is that genetically all males act this way. Genetically, all females act this way. This is the way we survive as a species. I'm just doing my thing. You're just doing your thing. And we're all servicing the greater good. I think that's that line of, this is what cults do. They lie with this. I mean, just think about, this is a cult. Yep. The definition of cult is groupthink, person at the top. You have sexual deviance going on. It's for profit and harm's being done. Those are the elements of a cult. So this is a cult mentality. You had the guy at the top and you had his underling, which was Maxwell.
Yeah. No, I mean, it makes, I mean, it doesn't make sense, but it's part of the recipe, you know, it's part of the recipe for this sort of human behavior. We're talking about Nobody's Girl, Virginia Giuffre's book that is out right now, posthumously telling her story, her life story of life before Epstein, with Epstein, after Epstein, and the damage that was done to her, and then the life that she tried to lead with all of that damage that was done by these soul ripper things. It's don't even want to call them people. Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, is with us. We were just talking in our first segment about Ghislaine Maxwell and how could she participate in this? How could she be part of the recruiting? I think one of the shocking parts of the book is the fact that Virginia herself talks about how she too eventually participated in the recruiting of other girls for Epstein to her own detriment. Let's break down that transparency that she has about this. Obviously, yeah. Ghislaine's always denied any of this, but Virginia flat out says, yeah, I was part of this and I did this. Let's talk about that and how she came to that, not necessarily realization, but feeling safe enough to say that out loud, almost as a warning to others out there.
Yeah, she was very transparent on the fact that Ghislaine would tell her go out. So they would send her out. So as soon as she established enough trust with them that they could let her out of their sight and send her places and to do things, especially when she went to actually when they paid for her to go to Thailand to get certified as a Thai masseuse, they sent her on a targeting mission. They actually identified someone in Thailand they wanted to try to recruit. And Ghislaine was calling her every single day. And that's where that pressure was applied from Ghislaine all the time. The pressure of wanting to and needing to satisfy her demands that's being placed on her. And a nonstop fear, an implied fear of retribution against family, against yourself, and against exposure for not complying. Because that's what traffickers will do. They'll guilt you into things. They'll shame you into things and they'll hold things above you. They took photos of all the girls. And so that's exactly what was going on was that exertion of that power and control that Ghislaine then had psychologically over her because she was the orchestrator of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and there's a comment there about the baby farm that I saw too. Yeah, so they actually, Jenna had reached the point where they trusted her enough that they approached her, both Ghislaine and Epstein together, to father Epstein's child. And they were going to set her up for life by carrying the baby, and that she was going to sign over all rights to the child. And they're going to then, and they gave her a dollar amount, exactly what they're going to pay her every month then to sustain. And that's what actually sent her over the edge to actually flee.
A baby farm.
Yep.
For those who have not read the book and you're trying to understand, I mean, what the hell does that mean?
They wanted her to father his children because he thought he was genetically superior to everyone. Again, very Hitler-like, very cult-like. And so their plan was to father a next generation of children that was all going to be part of the Epstein cabal. No kidding.
I mean, is that, is this an idea of they're going to start creating young people that are going to go out into the world and do whatever they're going to do with the super wonderful intelligence of Jeffrey Epstein? Or is this, let's start raising them from a very young age and grooming them literally from birth so Jeff can do horrible things?
They never explained it, but that's what she was contemplating.
Oh my God.
She said, the only thing that went through her mind was, my God, what happens if I have a baby girl?
Oh God.
Because she'd been because according to her, she's abused by her father. So she's mm-hmm. already been down that road too. and that's what it was too much for her. So she agreed and ran because she wanted to get them to get the hell away from her. And it's interesting too. So here's what was really so telling also about how she was regarded. So here they are. They trust her to go out and recruit girls, but a lot mm-hmm. of them were. They trust her that they actually paid for her to be away for like 6 months to get the certification as a masseuse, like she always wanted. So they were giving her a reward of this. They then trust her enough. And according to her, she thinks she was the first one that was ever offered this deal to become the baby farm mama. And then, so when she's over in Thailand going through the certification, she meets Robbie, her husband. And within weeks, they get married, and he tells her that you have to call Epstein and Maxwell and end it. And she calls Glenn, and tells her, and then she gets a call from Epstein who says, all right, have a great life. Click. So after all this, after all the trust, all the confidence, where she's thinking that I'm this very, very important person, what's the reverse optic? Nope, you're just a screwdriver. Next.
Yeah.
And she didn't have contact with him for 5 years. So literally, he called her on the phone and said, have a great life, click, no contact for 5 years. After all that, that's how much confidence he had. That he didn't have to maintain control of, in other words, he never thought this was a loose cannon. This wasn't an end that needed to be tied up. Mm-hmm. Total control of courts, total control of law enforcement, total control of images, of trafficking all these high-level friends and family and people in his life to all these girls, and never a worry in the world about it. That just shows that depth of confidence that this soul ripper had. That's what was really, because Tony, when you asked me about what was striking and stood out in the book, that's what really stood out in the book, was that depth of confidence that he had of getting away with it. And then so look at this. When you have that level of depth of confidence, because you own so many things, you have so much money, so much power, so much influence, and then when I did the research, the probability of suicide, it is so small. That's why you need that high level transparency from a level that you would trust that transparency coming from to say it wasn't a suicide, or that it was a suicide. Otherwise, you'd think it makes no sense.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make any sense, obviously. And you got Epstein, you got Ghislaine. We don't really have other people around them that have gone down for any of this. Do you think that it was really just the two of them running this on their own? What we're describing here, what we're talking about, seems like a much larger infrastructure. They recruited these young girls. Obviously, Virginia talks about it in the book, how she went out and recruited for them per their request. Was it really just that small of a group of evil, of a group of soul rippers, of Ghislaine and Jeffrey, or are there more pieces to this puzzle? Are there more bricks in the infrastructure of what is Epstein Island and what we think of as this thing, this entity that was able to bring all these women in over the years, all these young girls over the years for Jeffrey Epstein's, enjoyment, quote unquote, and for those that he brought in with him.
So as Jenna describes it, from my understanding of the optic that she painted was that the Epstein and Ghislaine were the two hub. They had staff. You had cooks, you had drivers, and you had pilots and people that were aware, but did the plausible deniability, like looking the other way. And I think from what I'm gathering from the book, again, all we have is Jenna's optic from the book that they were probably given deals because they weren't directly involved. They were just, I would say they're knowledgeable because Jenna even said, how could you not be knowledgeable of what was going around? You know, people like the driver, she knows the driver that Epstein had saw her naked but he denied it. And so I think you had a peripheral, but the ones that were actually involved in the actual recruiting were the recruited. So that's exactly how they worked this pyramid scheme. And it was a pyramid. It was a female recruiting teenager pyramid scheme where you Ghislaine would go in and you'd recruit one. And then that one was tasked with recruiting two. And so all the people that part of this infrastructure of sexual trafficking were the recruited. And they were all victims. And that's what was so tragic about this. I mean, they identified, I think, as she said in the book, I think about 200 girls that were victimized. And each one of those 200 girls were tasked with finding more. So it wasn't like they had a staff of Ghislaine's doing it. It was Ghislaine running for Epstein by getting the girls to do it. And here's where I think they were most likely working a statute of limitations on this, because at the time, I'm going to get this way wrong because I don't know the law on this as well. The statute of limitations, you had to actually be able to file lawsuits for being trafficked or sexual abuse or assault, and it expired within like a couple years. Like you had to file like by the age of 22 or 23. But did you know the stats of a woman coming forward to having the courage and having done the internal work to diffuse that internal time bomb these people have in them only happens in their 40s.
Yeah.
And so they were using the law on their side of that no one's going to say anything until statute of limitations is up, so we're safe. Oh my God, what a system.
it's insane. Virginia said in her book, if I'm ever found dead by suicide, never believe it. And now she's gone and the book is out. You know, coincidence?
So when I hit that point in the book, I was like, oh my God, this is, you know, you got to look at the suicide. And the family didn't even put out what caused suicide. But then later in the book, she did have two attempts of suicide by overdose. And now what's not covered in the book is that it's only rumor and that you're seeing that she actually had a hidden diary of her relationship with her husband. And there's a lot of other things I think were not covered in her personal life in that book, but she was very clearly a person struggling and fighting hard for life. Is it best way? It's hard not to get Missy talking about it. She was fighting hard for life, and for whatever reason, she didn't win. She loved her kids dearly. She loved life very dearly, but she was struggling.
Impossible. You know, I know she said that, and I'm sure she believed it at the moment when she made that statement.
Right.
But to have the mental baggage and the trauma and the hell that she went through, it's not unbelievable. In my mind, I think to think that her brain at some point it was too much, and there in a moment of whatever you want to call it. She was done and couldn't take anymore, couldn't process anymore. That's not a crazy thought that she, I think most people would have checked out far earlier, quite honestly.
There's a lot of things that she was working on. I mean, outside of the trauma itself, part of that trauma was the guilt. It wasn't just the trauma that was induced on her by Epstein. It was the guilt of recruiting girls that she was working through. And also the impact, she loved her kids so dearly, but she saw the media of attention that was the negative attention it was bringing on them as well. So she, and I remember when she talked about her first suicide attempt, again, full transparency on all these things, and the mindset she was in of, I just need to be out of their lives. It's better for them for me not to be here. I mean, this is why she was struggling on all she was being assaulted on all fronts about what's the worth of my life. And so it is understandable why she failed to keep herself alive, if that's indeed what happened.
Yeah. Stacey, what are we looking at from our comments right now?
Yeah, Shanna, I think it's Shanna. She's asking a question. She said, I'm not very familiar with any of this, but I have two questions. And the reason I'm bringing it up is maybe a lot of people aren't familiar with this. So her first question is, where were these girls' parents and family? And number two, what are the ages of the young girls? So if we could narrow it down a little bit to that. Obviously, we know that these families are probably not the best families, so they weren't looking out for these kids. That's probably answer to number one, right, Robin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. They were mostly coming from, unhealthy backgrounds, unhealthy homes, and they were enticed in by money, first of all, that they got groomed. It was a rapid grooming and social normalization that Ghislaine Maxwell would give them, because they felt safe because, like there's this one girl that Jenna talks about that got brought in, and Jenna even says it. Jenna said, hey, I'm going to bring you in to this house. If you want to, you get paid $200 to come in and give this old guy, a very rich guy, a massage. And the likelihood of him asking you to take your clothes off and do other things is pretty high. So she tried to counter her own guilt of doing what she's doing with the transparency. But I think what was happening, because the girl that they're talking to is also seeking to be approved, wanting to be part of a group because she's being ostracized. She's looking for money, needs money. I mean, all these things that the girl would say yes. And then she'd come in, and then Maxwell's in the room. Jenna's in the room, and it must be normal. It must be okay because it's X, Y, and Z. So that was part of how they did what they did, is they normalized behavior by other people saying it's okay. By their actions, not even necessarily words, their actions are saying this is okay. And when you don't have, you're not anchored in healthy and what that looks like and what that expectation is, it's redefining what healthy is to people that don't know what it is yet. And that's what was happening. And they didn't know it. You don't know what, I mean, I've covered this in some of my espionage cases I've talked about before, where at a very young age, when someone is broken or gets broken like that, and their definition of love now becomes this abhorrent behavior, they don't know what normal is. Yeah. Jenna even talks about that when she finally, I mean, she was overwhelmed when she met Robbie, her husband, because she actually loved him. She never had a choice of who she was going to be intimate with until that point in life. Mm-hmm. She didn't know what to do with that emotion. So that's what all these other girls are going through. They're being told what normal is. And that's what it became, because all these other girls are saying is, it must be, oh, and I'm getting cash, and they're saying they're going to do this or this, they're treating me nicely. And what happens is they use that validation. Like a girl would service Epstein, and as they're leaving, she says, you did a really fine job today. I think I see something special in you. I'm going to call you back, and I'm just be on your cell phone. Oh, you don't have a cell phone? Here, take this cell phone. And here's $200. Matter of fact, here's an extra $100. I'll call you tomorrow. I see something special in you. No one has ever said that to them before, and we're in.
It's like fishing. They set the hook.
Yeah.
What else do we got here, Stacey?
Alicia says, predators seem to always be looking for prey. And I think that is that's the one thing that I took from this entire story. But what I want to know, especially from you as a former FBI agent, what can we tell people to maybe watch for? You know, maybe we've got some friends who it's like, that relationship looks weird. Something's a little off. Are there huge red flags that we should be seeing?
Always. As always, transparency. Seek it in the people in your life. So had Jenna come from a household of healthy relationships where they were baselining what her normal communication was, because her communication with her family started falling off. Because what happens is you start hiding aspects of your life that you're ashamed to share. And so when you as an individual start seeing someone in your life becoming more isolated, less chatty, less sharing of what they're doing with their time. And it's by comparison, again, everything's an arc. Say someone comes home from school every day and you're used to, and you set up patterns of behavior with the people in your life you love. Every day when you come home from school, you're going to do X, Y, and Z. And at this certain time, we're going to tell me about your day. My wife did that. My kids came home every day. Tell me about your day. That was the first line out of our mouths every single day. Tell me about your day. And so we had a normal pattern of what we'd expect to hear every single day. Sometimes there'd be a blip if there's a bad thing, some teachers, grades, whatnot, but then we had a pattern and a tempo. If all of a sudden you start noticing gaps of time, what's going on in that time? Matter of fact, when we're doing statement analysis and when doing behavioral assessment, if you're trying to assess someone, if they're hiding something, if they're trying to lie or obscure something, have them write down chronologically, hey, well, just you say this is exactly what happened, write down your day for me. Boom, 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 boom. You'll notice what happens is people write and do statements in chronological order, but also in time blocks. They generally write in 10 to 15 minute time blocks. I did this, then I did this, then I did this. What happens is if all of a sudden you're analyzing, all right, every 15 minutes, all of a sudden we're missing an hour.
What happened in that hour?
Where's that hour? That's what we do. That's where the red flags are, is when we have gaps of time that are unexplained, that they are trying to avoid, they don't want to talk about. And also, obviously, the changes in behavior of too much stress, discomfort, on, you know, talking about things or people where people just get closed off. There's always leakage when there's a change for the unhealthy. We just have to have the courage and ability and presence to be observant of it and then take action.
And that applies in pretty much every avenue of your life, not just in this kind of a horrific situation. If you have a relationship with somebody and there's time periods missing where they're unaccountable, that kind of thing, pay attention. Yeah. Something's going on.
I guarantee you something's going on. And if you don't know what's going on, it's something they're ashamed to tell you, which means there's a lack of transparency. Lack of transparency is not a healthy behavior. We need to talk about what's going on that makes you feel not safe to share that information with them. Because if you don't feel safe to share that information, you fear retribution. So first, let's get off the retribution angle. Let's get off the shame angle. Let's just discuss what is. Then we can both have a conversation about cause and effect of behaviors. Because obviously, you know, if someone's doing something that's going to cause me to have a different reaction, you might not have been doing something healthy.
Yep.
All given our knowing glances and nods. And we're talking about lots of things in relationships.
Correct. Yeah. Robin. Nailed it.
I feel like tensed up in this conversation because it's such a dark.
I'm so sorry.
I think we'll wrap it up on that note. Nobody's Girl, it is out right now. It's a must read. If you want to have your eyes open to just the vile, soul-ripping world that does exist out there, as much as some people want to pretend it doesn't, or because it's icky or it's scary or whatever. It's there. And this is about as raw of an account as you're ever going to find in it. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. As always, thank you for coming on and giving your insight onto this topic. For everybody, for Stacey, for Todd and myself, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.